Chapter 14. Driving me to the station, and when we go back this evening I am to dine with him at Sherry's. I really feel as excited as if I were getting married myself. Lily smiled. She knew that Selden had always been kind to his dull cousin, and as he had sometimes wondered why he wasted so much time in such an unremunerative manner, but now the thought gave her a vague pleasure. "Do you see him often?" she asked. "Yes, he is very good about dropping in on Sundays. And now and then we do a play together, but lately I haven't seen much of him. He doesn't look well, and he seems nervous and unsettled. The dear fellow. I do wish he would marry some nice girl. I told him so today, but he said he didn't care for the really nice ones, and the other kind didn't care for him, but that was just his joke, of course. He could never marry a girl who wasn't nice. Oh, my dear, did you ever see such pearls?" They had paused before the table on which the bride's jewels were displayed, and Lily's heart gave an envious throb as she caught the refraction of light from their surfaces, the milky gleam of perfectly matched pearls, the flash of rubies relieved against contrasting velvet, the intense blue rays of sapphires kindled into light by surrounding diamonds. All these precious tints enhanced and deepened by the varied art of their setting. The glow of the stones warmed Lily's veins like wine. More completely than any other expression of wealth, they symbolized the life she longed to lead, the life of fastidious aloofness and refinement in which every detail should have the finish of a jewel, and the whole form a harmonious setting to her own jewel-like rareness. "Oh, Lily, do look at this diamond pendant. It's as big as a dinner plate. Who can have given it?" Miss Farish bent short-sightedly over the accompanying card. "M. Mr. Simon Rosedale." "What, that horrid man? Oh, yes, I remember, he's a friend of Jack's, and I suppose Cousin Grace had to ask him here today, but she must rather hate having to let Gwen accept such a present from him." Lily smiled. She doubted Mrs. Van Osburgh's reluctance, but was aware of Miss Farish's habit of ascribing her own delicacies of feeling to the persons least likely to be encumbered by them. "Well, if Gwen doesn't care to be seen wearing it, she can always exchange it for something else," she remarked. "Ah, here is something so much prettier," Miss Farish continued. "Do look at this exquisite white sapphire. I'm sure the person who chose it must have taken particular pains. What is the name? Percy Grice? Ah, then I'm not surprised." She smiled significantly as she replaced the card. "Oh, of course you've heard that he's perfectly devoted to Evie Van Osburgh. Cousin Grace is so pleased about it, it's quite a romance. He met her first at the George Dorsets, only about 6 weeks ago, and it's just the nicest possible marriage for dear Evie. Oh, I don't mean the money, of course, as he has plenty of her own, but she's such a quiet stay-at-home kind of girl, and it seems he has just the same tastes, so they are exactly suited to each other." Lily stood staring vacantly at the white sapphire on its velvet bed. Evie Van Osburgh and Percy Grice? The names rang derisively through her brain. Evie Van Osburgh? The youngest, dumpiest, dullest of the four dull and dumpy daughters whom Mrs. Van Osburgh, with unsurpassed astuteness, had laced one by one in enviable niches of existence. Ah, lucky girls who grow up in the shelter of a mother's love, a mother who knows how to contrive opportunities without conceding favors, how to take advantage of propinquity without allowing appetite to be dulled by habit. The cleverest girl may miscalculate where her own interests are concerned, may yield too much at one moment and withdraw too far at the next. It takes a mother's unerring vigilance and foresight to land her daughters safely in the arms of wealth and suitability. Lily's passing lightheartedness sank beneath a renewed sense of failure. Life was too stupid, too blundering. Why should Percy Grice's millions be joined to another great fortune? Why should this clumsy girl be put in possession of powers she would never know how to use? She was roused from these speculations by a familiar touch on her arm, and turning saw Gus Treanor beside her. She felt a thrill of vexation. What right had he to touch her? Luckily, Jordy Farish had wandered off to the next table, and they were alone. Treanor, looking stouter than ever in his tight frock coat, and unbecomingly flushed by the bridal libations, gazed at her with undisguised approval. By Jove, Lily, you do look a stunner. He had slipped insensibly into the use of her Christian name, and as he had never found the right moment to correct him. Besides, in her set all the men and women called each other by their Christian names. It was only on Treanor's lips that the familiar address had an unpleasant significance. Well, he continued, still jovially impervious to her annoyance, have you made up your mind which of these little trinkets you mean to duplicate at Tiffany's tomorrow? I've got a check for you in my pocket that will go a long way in that line. Lily gave him a startled look. His voice was louder than usual, and the room was beginning to fill with people. But as her glance assured her that they were still beyond earshot, a sense of pleasure replaced her apprehension. Another dividend? She asked, smiling and drawing near him in the desire not to be overheard. Well, not exactly. I sold out on the rise, and I've pulled off 4,000 for you. Not so bad for a beginner, eh? I suppose you'll begin to think you're a pretty knowing speculator. And perhaps you won't think poor old Gus such an awful ass as some people do. I think you the kindest of friends, but I can't thank you properly now. She let her eyes shine into his with a look that made up for the hand clasp he would have claimed if they had been alone, and how glad she was that they were not. The news filled her with the glow produced by a sudden cessation of physical pain. The world was not so stupid and blundering after all. Now and then a stroke of luck came to the unluckiest. At the thought her spirits began to rise. It was characteristic of her that one trifling piece of good fortune should give wings to all her hopes. Instantly came the reflection that Percy Grice was not irretrievably lost, and she smiled to think of the excitement of recapturing him from Evie Van Osburgh. What chance could such a simpleton have against her if she chose to exert herself? She glanced about, hoping to catch a glimpse of Grice, but her eyes lit instead on the glossy countenance of Mr. Rosedale, who was slipping through the crowd with an air half obsequious, half obtrusive, as though, the moment his presence was recognized, it would swell to the dimensions of the room. Not wishing to be the means of effecting this enlargement, Lily quickly transferred her glance to Treanor, to whom the expression of her gratitude seemed not to have brought the complete gratification as he had meant it to give. Hang thanking me, I don't want to be thanked, but I should like the chance to say two words to you now and then, he grumbled. I thought you were going to spend the whole autumn with us, and I've hardly laid eyes on you for the last month. Why can't you come back to Bellomont this evening? We're all alone, and Judy is as cross as two sticks. Do come and cheer a fellow up. If you say yes, I'll run you over in the motor, and you can telephone your maid to bring your traps from town by the next train. Lily shook her head with a charming semblance of regret. I wish I could, but it's quite impossible. My aunt has come back to town, and I must be with her for the next few days. Well, I've seen a good deal less of you since we've got to be such pals than I used to when you were Judy's friend, he continued with unconscious penetration. When I was Judy's friend. Am I not her friend still? Really, you say the most absurd things. If I were always at Bellomont, you would tire of me much sooner than Judy, but come and see me at my aunt's the next afternoon you are in town. Then we can have a nice quiet talk, and you can tell me how I had better invest my fortune. It was true that, during the last 3 or 4 weeks, as he had absented herself from Bellomont on the pretext of having other visits to pay, but she now began to feel that the reckoning she had thus contrived to evade had rolled up interest in the interval. The prospect of the nice quiet talk did not appear as all P97 greater than sufficing to Treanor as he had hoped, and his brows continued to lower as he said, "No, I don't know that I can promise you a fresh tip every day. But there's one thing you might do for me. and that is, just to be a little civil to Rosedale. Judy has promised to ask him to dine when we get to town, but I can't induce her to have him at Bellomont, and if he would let me bring him up now it would make a lot of difference. I don't believe two women have spoken to him this afternoon, and I can tell you he's a chap it pays to be decent to. Miss Bart made an impatient movement, but suppressed the words which seemed about to accompany it. After all, this was an unexpectedly easy way of acquitting her debt, and had she not reasons of her own for wishing to be civil to Mr. Rosedale? Oh, bring him by all means, she said smiling. Perhaps I can get a tip out of him on my own account. Trina paused abruptly, and his eyes fixed themselves on hers with a look which made her change color. I say, you know you'll please remember he's a blooming bounder, he said, and with a slight laugh she turned toward the open window near which they had been standing. The throng in the room had increased, and she felt a desire for space and fresh air. Both of these she found on the terrace, where only a few men were lingering over cigarettes and liqueur, while scattered couples strolled across the lawn to the autumn-tinted borders of the flower garden. As she emerged, a man moved toward her from the knot of smokers, and she found herself face to face with Selden. The stir of the pulses which his nearness always caused was increased by a slight sense of constraint. They had not met since their Sunday afternoon walk at Bellomont, and that episode was still so vivid to her that she could hardly believe him to be less conscious of it. But his greeting expressed no more than the satisfaction which every pretty woman expects to see reflected in masculine eyes, and the discovery, if distasteful to her vanity, was reassuring to her nerves. Between the relief of her escape from Trina, and the vague apprehension of her meeting with Rosedale, it was pleasant to rest a moment on the sense of complete understanding which Lawrence Selden's manner always conveyed. This is luck, he said smiling. I was wondering if I should be able to have a word with you before the special snatches us away. I came with Judy Farish, and promised not to let her miss the train, but I am sure she is still extracting sentimental solace from the wedding presents. She appears to regard their number and value as evidence of the disinterested affection of the contracting parties. There was not the least trace of embarrassment in his voice, and as he spoke, leaning slightly against the jamb of the window, and letting his eyes rest on her in the frank enjoyment of her grace, she felt with a faint chill of regret that he had gone back without an effort to the footing on which they had stood before their last talk together. Her vanity was stung by the sight of his unscathed smile. She longed to be to him something more than a piece of sentient prettiness, a passing diversion to his eye and brain, and the longing betrayed itself in her reply. Ah, she said, I envy Judy that power as he has of dressing up with romance all our ugly and prosaic arrangements. I have never recovered my self-respect since you showed me how poor and unimportant my ambitions were. The words were hardly spoken when she realized their infelicity. It seemed to be her fate to appear at her worst to Selden. I thought, on the contrary, he returned lightly, that I had been the means of proving they were more important to you than anything else. It was as if the eager current of her being had been checked by a sudden obstacle which drove it back upon itself. She looked at him helplessly, like a hurt or frightened child. This real self of hers, which he had the faculty of drawing out of the depths, was so little accustomed to go alone. The appeal of her helplessness touched in him, as it always did, a latent chord of inclination. It would have meant nothing to him to discover that his nearness made her more brilliant, but this glimpse of a twilight mood to which he alone had the clue seemed once more to set him in a world apart with her. At least you can't think worse things of me than you say, she exclaimed with a trembling laugh. But before he could answer, the flow of comprehension between them was abruptly stayed by the reappearance of Gus Trina, who advanced with Mr. Rosedale in his wake. Hang it, Lily, I thought you'd given me the slip. Rosedale and I have been hunting all over for you. His voice had a note of conjugal familiarity. Miss Bart fancied she detected in Rosedale's eye a twinkling perception of the fact, and the idea turned her dislike of him to repugnance. She returned his profound bow with a slight nod, made more disdainful by the sense of Selden's surprise that she should number Rosedale among her acquaintances. Trina had turned away, and his companion continued to stand before Miss Bart, alert and expectant, his lips parted in a smile at whatever she might be about to say, and his very back conscious of the privilege of being seen with her. It was the moment for tact, for the quick bridging over of gaps, but Selden still leaned against the window, a detached observer of the scene, and under the spell of his observation Lily felt herself powerless to exert her usual arts. The dread of Selden suspecting that there was any need for her to propitiate such a man as Rosedale checked the trivial phrases of politeness. Rosedale still stood before her in an expectant attitude, and she continued to face him in silence, her glance just level with his polished baldness. The look put the finishing touch to what her silence implied. He reddened slowly, shifting from one foot to the other, fingered the plump black pearl in his tie, and gave a nervous twist to his mustache. Then, running his eye over her, he drew back, and said, with a side glance at Selden Colin, upon my soul, I never saw a more ripping get-up. Is that the last creation of the dressmaker you go to see at the Benedict? If so, I wonder all the other women don't go to her too. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.